And once we publish this out as a podcast episode, everyone will get to see before they listen exactly how long it is. So it at least has that assurance over the typical international slideshow. You don't have to sit and wonder at the beginning exactly how long it's going to go on for.
So true. And it's not one of our longer episodes, actually.
No, I don't think it will be. Hi, I'm Joe. I'm joined by my good friend Adam, and we're getting reacquainted after 20 years apart.
Hello, I'm Adam, and I'm getting reacquainted with Joe after 20 years apart.
So, we've spent the last 12 weeks talking about politics, and we've talked a good bit about careers and entertainment before then. We've really gone over soup to nuts what we've been up to, but there's one very, very big thing that you did that we haven't talked about at all, and that's in between leaving Korea and showing up on this podcast, you actually took a trip that covered a decent percentage of Western Europe and Asia.
I did. I took the long way home over the course of 2016 from the end of February, well, mid-February, all the way to November. My wife and I traveled the world. We started, just a real quick overview.
Sure.
We started in Japan because we couldn't believe that we had lived in South Korea for 4 years and not been to Japan yet. We jumped from there over to New Zealand, where we stayed for a solid 2 months, I believe. Maybe just a 1 month. And a month. And then we jumped over to Australia, cut up through Southeast Asia, took a quick hop to China, and from Mongolia, we rode a train through Russia and into Europe, where we gallivanted around for the remaining 3 months of our trip, whereupon we got on board a ship in Le Havre and sailed back to the good old USA. So that was a fantastic trip. I would say a once-in-a-lifetime trip, but, why put that out there? Who knows? Maybe I can be that absolutely lucky to do it again.
Sounds like an incredible trip. And you said this was about a 7, 8, 9 month trip from start to finish?
About 10, yeah.
About 10 months. So what prompted you and Anna to take a trip like this?
Well, as these things do, it just sort of got out of control. We actually intended originally to just stay in New Zealand for a few months and hang out there while we got our bearings and just take a nice peaceful break before heading back to the U.S. to start phase 2 or 3 of life. However, we figured if you're going to go to New Zealand, why not go to Australia? And then the South Korean government did something that really just changed our whole perspective of the situation. That is to say that South Korea and the United States have this reciprocal agreement whereby you receive all of the money that goes into your Social Security and whatnot if you're leaving. And so instead of just getting our severance from our employer, we received an extra $30,000 or so.
Wow.
from the ROK. And suddenly a lot more seemed possible. So we did the math and made a budget and blew it a little bit. But just went ahead and did it.
That is really cool. So what kind of planning did you do before setting out on this trip? I don't think you just hopped a plane and figured you'd, or a boat and figured you'd make it up as you went along. So what kind of planning went into this?
Yeah, not so much. I appreciate your mind, Joe. The first question that comes to you, of course, is the logistics of it all. and I don't disagree. That's generally how I approach a large problem, too. Well, we had help. There were markers we essentially had to hit, which is to say that if you are meeting your siblings in Germany, because they have their vacation time in September or what have you, then that automatically puts a limit on how long you can stay in Russia and so on and so forth. So we had a few markers we had to hit like that. One or two festivals that we really wanted to attend. There were visa limitations in some cases. I know New Zealand only wants you to stick around so long. They're paranoid about people overstaying their visas. And sometimes it was as simple as breaking things down very emotionlessly. Okay, there's four countries, so that's 1 week each. And then deciding, but we're not actually that interested in this country, so let's add a few days onto this one. And it's a broad outline, ultimately. You don't have to go entirely by the plan, except for the airplane tickets you've bought in advance. You can afford to stay somewhere longer if you want to. So, you know, a little column A, a little column B. It was all broadly planned, but there was wiggle room in there, which was nice. And we definitely used it. I believe we spent twice as long in some countries as we planned to, just because we were having such a good time. One or two countries we got the hell out of.
So you started in Japan, and I'm just going to kind of ask some questions and let you fill in whatever local color you want to, because I've got some vague memories perhaps of photos or videos you might have posted during your trip. Japan, I remember you posting a video of a sumo wrestling match, I believe.
Yes. I don't think you're remembering a full video. I think it was part of our 1 second every day montage.
That sounds about right.
Yeah. Just the moment when those two sumo wrestlers impact. we did catch that on camera. Yeah. Japan and, you know, East Asia is kind of like, you know, it all has the similarities, but they're all very different flavors. And Japan is really one of those countries that lives up to not the hype, but the expectations, I would say. I think when you go to England, if you're an American and you've read your Charles Dickens and your Holmes, and you know there's a more modern version, but there should be all this Victorian architecture around and so forth, that you're hoping for that twee feeling, perhaps, or that, you know, that flavor, that sense that you got from all that media. And you get it in Japan. There are some wonderful sights, but what will stick with you, I think, from the beginning is how quiet it is and how peaceful. The Japanese are the polar opposites of Americans. They don't like making noise. Perhaps in part because they have such tidy rooms and everyone can probably hear everybody. But you can be walking along in a fairly large city, but not feel like you're at a concert.
So kind of the opposite of New York City, jam-packed with just as many people, but a much quieter experience, it sounds like.
Sure, in many places far more people, but it's not loud. it really isn't. When you go to Japan, you want to hit the highlights. You want to hit the highlights anywhere, of course, but what do you think of when you think of Japan? You think of sumo wrestlers. So I went and saw sumo wrestlers. You think of samurai. So you want to see the old fortresses and the armor and whatnot. So, you know, we did all that. Totoro, we went to see Studio Ghibli. They have their own small, not amusement park really, but museum.
Okay.
And there is in fact a theater there, which doesn't show them films that you know and love. They have four original short films by Hayao Miyazaki, and they only show them there. And so when you get the ticket, you get to see one of them, but your experience may not be like the other person's. And that was cool. And the film, of course, was, as you might expect, charming and sweet and well worth the 15 minutes.
This is where I have to admit I have never actually watched anything by Miyazaki, in spite of having heard of those films for years.
Oh, God.
Studio Ghibli is, it's on my list. I need to watch them, but I just haven't yet. Maybe this will finally be the impetus I need.
Well, the world's so full of amazing stories and wonderful media, so obviously you never get around to everything. But yeah, in fact, we brought back Totoro dolls for my little sisters, who are 7 years old, both of them.
Oh, cool.
And we did that back when they were small, because, of course, the character is popular in Korea and China as well. And so that's their, the teddy bears that they've never been without since they were little. They're Totoro dolls. And my parents cursed the day they ever heard of these creatures. So Japan is magical, I would say. It's you go there and you get the experience that you hoped for.
Now, I'm trying to figure out how to phrase this question, but Japan is obviously very close to South Korea, and historically, from what I understand, Japan has had a huge influence on South Korea, or rather the South Koreans have perhaps felt that Japan had rather too much involvement in their history. How did that change your experience of Japan, your knowledge of Korean history and of that history between the two countries, and having just spent multiple years in South Korea? Did that have any kind of an impact on how you experienced Japan, or how you thought about Japanese culture while you were over there?
Oh, yeah. I liked that because it meant that I got more than the surface level. I could look for details that were maybe a layer deeper than the basic stuff that's so weird that we don't do in America, because it's all based on Confucian culture, China, Korea, Japan. So instead of remarking, "Oh, that's interesting," they bow. You know, I could note how they bowed at different times than the Koreans, or, you know, or they only did it in certain cases. It was nice to go in with that understanding. But
kind of that baseline understanding of Confucian culture that you can then filter out and pay attention to more.
Sure. And also this, I've eaten a lot of Korean food and also a lot of Japanese food, because when you're right next door, you know, it's everywhere. So seeing how they did Japanese dishes differently from Korea, you know, and so on and so forth. So yeah, that was really cool. But to go back to the England example, this is a cliche, you know, if you ask anyone who's been there, they'll roll their eyes and be like, yeah, yeah. But Japan is Britain and Korea is Ireland.
Okay.
You know, the Japanese are, and you know, this is where we get a lot of our ideas about Orientalism and the rest. They're far more reserved, you know, emotionally and, more advanced and so on. And whereas the Koreans are far harder drinkers and much more boisterous and, you know, not, it really does fit. There's a reason that cliche is stuck around.
That's what I hadn't heard about before, but now that you mention it, it brings into clarity some other things you've mentioned about Korean culture in past episodes. And suddenly that feels like a very apt description of the relationship between the two countries.
Yeah, from the colonialism on, it works really well. So it was cool getting to see, you know, the East Asian London.
There you go. So from Japan, you went to New Zealand. Now, was that a plane ride for you? Was that a boat ride? How did you get over to New Zealand?
It was a plane ride. It was a plane ride that we almost missed. I don't know if I mentioned this to you ever, but New Zealand... Okay, so I have mentioned it this very podcast. New Zealand is paranoid about you overstaying your visa. And they are very fair about it. Even Americans don't get a pass. So we were sitting in our airport in Tokyo waiting for our flight to New Zealand. And we were hours in advance. But my wife, bless her, likes to have all of her ducks in a row. So, right when the desk for our flight opened up, you know, an hour in advance. She went up there to confirm our reservation. You know, it's like, honey, this has never been a problem before. Of course, I said, but she checked. And they would not have let us on the plane because we did not have a flight already booked out of New Zealand.
Oh.
To Australia. So we engaged in the sort of furious laptop typing that you generally only see on, you know, 1 hour TV shows about hackers. Bought our tickets to Australia. Then, and thank you, to the Australian government, we bought an e-visa, which, you know, it comes up almost instantaneously. You know, it takes a few minutes to work through the system, and then it's out. There's no embassy visit or anything like that. So we managed to come in right under the wire because we bought both our tickets to Australia and got our visas just before that plane took off. So then, you know, so that was our exciting start to our journey in New Zealand.
Welcome to New Zealand. Y'all come back now, you hear, which means you need to leave first.
Exactly. New Zealand was special. My wife lived there for a semester as an exchange student in college. So she already had friends there and a lot of very special memories. It was really a golden time for her. And so she'd always wanted to share it with me. So we spent the first several weeks, maybe as long as a month, on the North Island, primarily in not Christchurch. Oh my gosh, what am I trying to say? Not Auckland. Ooh, that's really embarrassing. Hold on. I'm going to force you to edit out this. Wellington. Yes, the capital of New Zealand. spent most of
just
our
a small
time
minor
there.
City.
Right. And then we spent the other month on the South Island, where we herded sheep.
I was going to mention that. I remembered seeing some pictures on probably Instagram of you and Anna with sheep multiple times. It seemed like you got fairly involved in the sheep lifestyle for a little bit.
Yeah, well, that's everyone's favorite factoid about New Zealand, other than Lord of the Rings-related stuff, that there are more sheep than people on those two islands. And I suppose it's true. We wanted to cut down on our living expenses by doing some woofing, which is the Worldwide Organization of Organic Farmers. And, of course, that got turned into a verb. So we volunteered our services in exchange for a place to stay and a seat at the dinner table for a couple weeks working with a sheep farmer on the South Island. And that was very educational.
I can imagine.
Yeah, I am not handy. So I had a steep learning curve, to be sure. I could have killed myself with a chainsaw one day. You know, it's just all sorts of near misfires. But hopefully, you know, hopefully we were more helpful than a pain.
So what kind of stuff do you do on a sheep farm? You know, I think of it as just the sheep go out, the sheep come back in, but it sounds like it was more involved than that.
Oh, yeah. You gotta move them from one pasture to another because, you know, occasionally that's rotation is what, you know, keeps you with the grass that you need before they eat it all and so forth. You have to mark the male sheep, or you have to mark the sheep as they get pregnant so that the dumb sheep aren't still running around with the ones that are already taken care of. So every day, you know, you're sorting them, essentially. It's interesting how that happens. You have to snap a harness onto the male sheep. And that harness has on its stomach a gigantic crayon, essentially. And so whenever they mount an ewe, they mark the sheep.
Literally.
Yeah. Now, the problem with this, of course, is that that means that you have to wrestle the harnesses onto the male sheep. And at least one case, you know, this just meant me holding on to the animal while, you know, it made a run for it. So that sort of thing. And if we just missed shaving off their wool. I was sad about that. But that's pretty much the only thing we didn't do.
That would have been an experience.
Yeah. There are 100 details we can talk about with each of these countries, and so it's difficult to know what to say. But I can summarize New Zealand easily. Because that country has only really been inhabited by mankind since what we would consider to be the Middle Ages, and since Europe only arrived there late, New Zealand is the country that will turn you into an environmentalist faster than any place in the world. You go there, and since they don't have a whole lot of history, a lot of the signs are just about the natural habitat and how it formed and conservation efforts and that sort of thing. And you see these absolutely stunning sights, and you see these beaches with penguins and all these other wonders. You know, this sky that, due to New Zealand's place in the world and also lack of pollution, just doesn't look like other skies you've seen. It's, you know, it seems so much more close to the ground, like you could reach up and touch it sometimes. And you know, after you catch your breath at these sights, you read the sign. And it describes to you how much more used to be there. And you're almost appalled, because you've never seen something so beautiful before. And then you hear that this is what's left. it just gives you something to measure the rest of the world by. It gives you a yardstick that you don't really have, a frame of reference. It's hard to get mad about something when you've never known anything else. And so seeing New Zealand was really eye-opening in that sense.
Almost one of those places where you really can step back in time and see it how it was, how it used to be.
Exactly. That's what I remember about it, really. These gorgeous vistas, this amazingly diverse geography, that's what I came away with, really. When we went from there to Australia, we just stayed in Melbourne for a week to see some friends, and I had some free time to kill. And what I decided to do with my free time was go to the Museum of Natural History.
Hmm.
Because that was, you know, that was the impression left upon me. I wanted to know more. You know, I tend to read history books. We both do. But it's usually about wars and politics and developments of cultures and stuff. Before now, it had been so very long since I wanted to pick up a book about dinosaurs or about the forming of the planet, of the continents. So that's, you go into traveling, at least I do, hoping for more than just entertainment, you know, for eye-opening experiences, to be changed. And so New Zealand was very satisfying on that score, because I did feel like I had learned something.
So you went to Australia for a week. You were in Melbourne hanging out with some friends. Anything, I suppose, especially notable about Australia, or was it more of just a waypoint between New Zealand and Singapore?
Oh, I suppose it's at most an asterisk at the end of our New Zealand trip, but as far as the unexpected goes, I think it is interesting to see the importance that the Commonwealth nations still place on World War I, because we happen to arrive at a particularly notable Armistice Day, I think, or something of that sort. They were celebrating World War I or the veterans, and the memorials and the ceremonies were markedly somber and, you know, respected. So that was interesting. That's a cultural divide, I think. America does not think of World War I as much as it thinks of World War II. It's not treated as a somber tragedy of an event. We asked New Zealanders what we should do in Melbourne, and it was funny. The responses we always got were, well, do you like arcades and coffee shops? Because, you know, it's very lovely architecture and so on and so forth. And we said, well, we're going to Australia, not Venice. You know, it's, it seemed strange, but actually due to a large immigrant population of Italians and others, that describes Melbourne pretty well. It feels like an old European city, newly built. The grime of 10 centuries has not worked its way into the cobblestones yet, which makes it a very pleasant place to be. But no, the most fun we had in Australia, and one of the things you can't really talk about much, I suppose, is just the wildlife, of course. We went to a reserve and saw the kangaroos and the wombats, and the koalas. So that was a thrill.
You know, Australia is also notable because it is the first of the postcards that I received from you on the trip, of which I received several. And I understand I was not the only person that received postcards while you were doing your round-the-world trip.
Yeah, this is true. So Anna and I made a misjudgment, although a well-intentioned one. We thought to ourselves, well, we really want to keep shopping to a minimum, because if we just buy things when they take our fancy, we're going to own a lot of extra junk, which is going to be expensive to ship home. And the same is true for gifts. We're big gift givers. And if we just buy things for people, then we're going to spend thousands and thousands of dollars. And so we decided, we hit upon this elegant solution that we would just send postcards to friends and family. And we would do this in a somewhat hierarchical fashion, which is to say that mothers would receive a card from every country, you know, and brothers are high priority cases. And then we'd send other cards as we thought the interests of our friends might dictate, and so forth. The result of this was that we wrote a lot of postcards. We just couldn't quite help ourselves either. So, you know, I have here my journal, and I noticed that on this one page it says that we sat down and wrote 20 postcards. And overall, we did. We wrote hundreds of postcards, and all told, the total value of them probably equaled a decent gift for each family member. So,
I imagine mailing these international was not that cheap either. Once you're getting into 20, 40, or 200 posted from different countries.
Exactly. So, you know, it wasn't a big deal individually, but on the whole, when you have 50 people you want to write to, it adds up very quickly. Yeah, that was one of the things we did to try to make the trip meaningful, though. We know people who would say, just enjoy it, but Anna and I felt burdened by this need to make it mean something. You know, we're the sorts that feel like traveling had to do something, and so that just was one of the ways that seemed like it would help if, you know, we used the opportunity, especially since we were coming back to America, to strengthen connections. You know, I mean, if we're coming back and it's like, hey, we've been gone 4 years, then that's not so great. But, you know, you'd have to spend time reestablishing those relationships. But we thought it would be a great way of showing people that we cared if we started writing them while we were on this big adventure.
Oh, that makes sense. I'm guessing this maybe was a little bit of a challenge from perhaps a perspective you might not think of. I'm looking at the postcards, and you've got this incredible small writing on each one of them. That maybe that's just the way you write all of the time, but this has more the look of a postcard-specific form of writing that, I don't know, my hand feels like it's cramping up just looking at it.
Well, actually, and this is a shame that we've turned the video off for this segment, but if you flip to any page of my journal, that is how I write. Not necessarily that small, because I was trying to cram information on the postcard, but my handwriting style is the Courier font of the world. I stick to those block letters usually.
Okay.
So there you have it. I do have some pretty mean cursive when I want to break it out, but that's my default.
Okay, so Australia is at least the first of the postcards I received. And then from Australia, anything else you want to say about Australia before I move us along?
Not really.
So after Australia, you hit up Singapore. And then I've got down here Malaysia, Thailand, Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam. So how long did you spend kind of on that little... Because those countries are all fairly close together, I believe. How long did you spend on that segment of the trip?
A few months. And with different amounts of time, again, depending on how we felt about a country or what our connections were there. Singapore was a jaunt, a day trip. But in Malaysia, we were fortunate enough to know or to have a best friend who was originally from there, one of Anna's besties. And so we stayed with her Indian Malaysian parents. And so we went ahead and, you know, stayed a solid week or two in their house. And that was cool. It's always, when you can just sort of rest and take a moment off from the, landmark treadmill, then I feel like you have more of a chance to just absorb, a country and the peculiarities of it.
Right. No, that makes sense. So you stayed with your friend's parents in Malaysia. I seem to have some kind of a memory about elephants or an elephant preserve around this leg of the trip.
Yes, in Laos. And that in part goes back to the whole renewed interest in the natural world. But my favorite animals have always been pachyderms and, whales. So two of the things that I did while I was on this trip is I went ahead and paid the money to get a good close look at them. So this preserve was really interesting. Usually the economic model for elephant owners is that they let you take pictures with them and they let you have a ride on them. And this preserve didn't do that. You paid a premium amount of money in order to stay on the reservation. And then at opportune times, they would lead your group of people, which was usually pretty small. You got to go hang out with the elephants at a time that wasn't distressful for them. And that was pretty magical. You know, I got to, there's always been a longing, you know, whenever you go to the zoo, to actually interact, to reach out and touch them. But you don't want to take advantage of them either. So we finally got to do that. You know, I got to feed the elephant and pat it, and I couldn't resist. Hell, I gave it a hug. It was just this lifetime, you know, achievement unlocked. They're such magical creatures, and amazingly intelligent. Their problem-solving skills. The 3 days we spent there were also spent learning about elephants. To give you an idea of how much it affected me, I have a novel about half written right now about activities that are closely related to elephant preservation, and I'll discuss it more with you sometime. But that and my trip out to see a sperm whale on the coast of New Zealand were absolute highlights.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. Really, Southeast Asia had both the most magical moments of the trip, perhaps, and also the most heartbreaking. They're extremes in that part of the continent. I think I wrote to you from Vietnam as well, didn't I?
You did. Yeah, and I was just looking at the postcard for both Malaysia and for Vietnam. Malaysia, you mentioned you got to sit out under a pavilion sipping tea while people picked it for your entertainment.
Oh, God. Yeah, man. Well, one of my less colorful jokes. The thing about Malaysia was that I knew nothing about it. I had never considered going there. It just wasn't on my radar. And I found it really fascinating. There wasn't much in the way of history to read about it, I did find and read one book. And so I guess if there is a lesson I learned about Malaysia, or learned from Malaysia, it was that there's gold in their hills, or perhaps there's more than is dreamt of in your philosophy. We as Americans tend to spend a lot of time thinking about Europe and Russia, and maybe because of our fascination with the East, Japan and China, and of course the bedlam that goes on in the Middle East. But you know, there are these, I know for me, there are these large swaths of our world that I am very ignorant about. And every place is fascinating in its own way once you get into the details. So Malaysia was a good reminder that there is a lot more out there to see and experience and learn about. It was also the only country I went to and with a Muslim population, a majority. So that was interesting.
And not something you think of when you think of the East and you think of Malaysia.
No, not at all. But we stepped off the train from Singapore in the dead of night, just the dark hours of the morning. And we were practically, after everyone had run in their taxis, we had to transfer to another, to a bus line. And we were going to have to walk there. And so we were walking with our cases through these, you know, oversized, wide streets with these madrasas towering over us, you know, lit up by these nightlights. And then while we were walking through this abandoned, dark city, you know, the Muslim call to prayer reverberated throughout the town. And so it was just that sort of marked it for us. We knew we were in a different place.
Indeed. You just mentioned you stepped off of the train from Singapore. Now Singapore, as I've understood, is an island city state. So there is indeed a train that runs between Singapore and Malaysia?
Yeah, absolutely. Just as you know, there's a train that'll take you to the mainland and so many cities that are just kind of a little bit off the coast, like Manhattan to New Jersey, sort of, or what have you. That's a good example of the fascinating history. Why is there a Singapore? Why isn't Singapore the New York City of Malaysia? The two have a good relationship, essentially, because Singapore used to be part of Malaysia. But now they don't. They have a border. The short of it all is that you have these several large demographics. The Malays, who are the natives, of course, but also about a quarter of Malaysia is Chinese now, due to a couple of hundred years of history and also colonialism. And then 7% of it is Indian. So as many as there are Asians in America, for example. And so Singapore originally wanted to be included in Malaysia. Malaysia is a federation of Malay states, and some Malay states are now their own countries, and the majority of them are part of Malaysia. And Singapore was the city-state that wanted to be included in the federation. The problem with that is that Singapore is 75% Chinese. Mm. And so if you want a country that is dominantly Malaysian, then including, you know, an extra couple million Chinese would cause problems with that. And so that is the sort of concern, a series of issues related to ethnicity and other matters that resulted in this odd situation of this island city-state being kind of originally hung out to dry. They wanted to be part of Malaysia, didn't know how they were going to survive without them. And now, of course, Singapore is this enormous success story and wouldn't want to be part of Malaysia if Malaysia wanted it to be.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, it made a lot of sense at the time, and things just developed from there. No, I actually, you'll see on my Goodreads list, the history book I read about Malaysia. I thoroughly recommend it.
Yeah, I'll have to check that out. And this may be a time to mention, you and Anna did a fair amount of reading, either in preparation for or during this trip, related to each of the countries you visited.
Yeah. Once again, it goes back to trying to make the trip in some way productive, purposeful. Maybe it's just middle-class guilt that we have the money to spend to do this. Call it what you will. But we read one history book about each of the countries we visited, or I did, and Anna and I read one novel from each of the countries we visited, in English translation, of course. And in the case of Singapore and Malaysia, that was very interesting because the novels that we read were not written by Malays. They were written by Chinese Malaysians. And furthermore, in Singapore, the Chinese are often native speakers of English because English is a language of business. So, you know,
Singapore is nothing if not a city-state of business.
Exactly. So, you know, we started off the trip with three English novels, I would say. We had New Zealand, we had Australia, and we had Singapore. And the Malaysian novel was quite good, by the way. The Garden of Evening Mist.
Sounds like a very stereotypical Asian title.
It does. And actually, the book rather lampshades that. But it is very much about Malaysia, and in particular the Cameron Highlands, where we were.
Okay.
Yeah, and as Forrest Gump would say, that's all I have to say about that.
So, after Malaysia, Thailand, Laos, and Cambodia, before hitting Vietnam, anything you want to say about Thailand, Laos, or Cambodia? And I feel like we're at risk of giving short shrift to some countries, but at the same time, I feel like if we spend 20 minutes on each one, we'll never finish this.
Right, yeah, I feel like we've made a mistake, in some cases, spending as much time as we have on some of them already. You know, and you do short shrift to any country, really, just by not giving hour-long lectures about them. They were all interesting. Laos, we primarily went to for the elephant sanctuary, but it's a gorgeous land, and very laid back, actually. That's kind of interesting. Thailand is bustle. It's hustle. It's everyone's generally, in the cities anyway, moving around and hawking, in no small part because, of course, Thailand's economic model is based in part on being the playground of other countries. You know, it's just one big Disneyland. But when you go to Laos, all of a sudden the energy completely changes. It's like you might imagine a banana republic in the Caribbean being. Everyone is just laid back. You know, it's hot. The police officer in his green communist uniform, you know, brushes a fly away. So that was interesting. That said, Laos and Cambodia both, and Vietnam, each in a different way, broke my heart. That is where we encountered the most severe poverty, or the most abominable history. And despite, much like you, you know, reading histories of the Holocaust and so forth, that was actually the most affecting part of the trip as far as grief goes. Seeing photos and documentation of what went on there just in the last century.
Yeah, absolutely. So looking at Vietnam, and again, I'm partially pulling this just from the postcards that you had sent and that I was able to read through. Seems like you were fairly affected, or at least noticed and stood out by the dichotomy between Vietnam as an officially still communist country, and yet it sounds like a fair bit of capitalist entrepreneurship and creativity on the part of the people there.
Oh, very much so. It's a one-party capitalist state at this point. The Southeast Asia and China have shown what illusion. It was our whole idea that capitalism and democracy are intimately linked. And, you know, you can't possibly have one without creating the other. In fact, perhaps capitalism has assisted in the securing of the country by the state, because a happy populace is a much more content populace, which means they agitate less. Vietnam is definitely on the China track of just being open for business, and it is interesting to see a Starbucks with a communist flag hanging from it.
That does seem a very interesting dichotomy. And you had been reading at this point a book that I then subsequently read, and the title of which now escapes me, so I'm not even going to try to remember it. But a book that talked about the lead up to the Vietnam War and the lead up to the American involvement in the Vietnam War and everything that went on with the French and with colonialism. And I've done some subsequent other reading on the Middle East and the East. And what strikes me is we grew up learning, and I think other Americans lived through this experience where we viewed communism and capitalism, the communist parties in these countries, as being unalterably opposed to the American way of life and to American security. But as we're seeing in China, and as you saw in Vietnam, it really almost sounds like they weren't necessarily as opposed as we had thought they were, that in some ways the East has really assimilated a kind of capitalism into communism and into single-party control of a country.
I would agree with that. They've taken what they want, which is really what cultures have always done in religion, in economics, and in everything else. You know, they adapt what they see to their own standards and specifications. It just occurred to me that I did an interview with the Vietnamese ambassador to South Korea back when I was working at Gwangju News. And after our interview, I watched him engage in a lecture followed by a question and answer session. And there was a young American who I suspect was raised much as we were, who asked about that dichotomy, you know, who said, "Well, are you still really communist?" And it was interesting, and how the ambassador answered. He said, "Listen, you know, communism is about equality and providing for people and making sure everyone, you know, everyone is lifted up. And so the methodology of that is fungible or changeable." You know, he gave a wide definition of it, and I think that sort of logic is something that you see in a lot of places and which is understandable.
Yeah, it makes the Vietnam War even more of a tragedy than it already was. This realization that we went in there and we fought for so many years, we killed so many, we had so many killed, and today Vietnam is a communist country, and I don't know if officially an ally of the U.S., but certainly from everything I've heard, very, very friendly towards the U.S., and it makes you wonder, okay, what were we fighting for in the first place then?
Right. Vietnam almost immediately turned around after they successfully kicked us out and started becoming more antagonistic with China, because China was is a continuous threat. You know, it's the big boy on the block, and the two had a war, I believe, in the 80s, a short one, because China trounced them. But, yeah, right, it was very much about pragmatism. And yet, and here we go, and yet, the Korean War was very similar. It's funny, the Forgotten War, the Korean War, was in so many ways very similar to the Vietnamese War. And we won that one, and the thing is that we were almost undoubtedly the bad guys in the Korean War. I think it was a much more black and white scenario than in the Vietnamese War, that we were not the heroes. And yet, clearly the situation has developed And I think everyone would agree that, at least for some time, it was a very good thing that the American forces were there. And yet, and furthermore, would Vietnam be the country it is today without the capitalist influence of the United States? So obviously we didn't have to, we shouldn't have fought them, but clearly we had, you know, we had this alternative economic system that has turned out very well for them.
And it strikes me, and I'm just going to mention this briefly because I don't want to divert this into a new political podcast, but it strikes me that perhaps we got a little bit too scared of communism in the 50s and 60s and forgot to pay attention to just normal geopolitical interests, that China and Russia were perhaps never going to be friends. They were always going to be rivals, given their sizes and the influence that they historically had had in that region of the world. And related to that, the rest of the Eastern Asian countries weren't going to be natural allies of China. They were going to be rivals to China because China was the big boy on the block that nobody wanted to be dominated by.
Mm-hmm.
So even if they were all communist, it didn't necessarily follow that they were all going to be friends and working hand in hand.
Yeah, we bought a lot of the communists' own rhetoric.
So we'll move on, as you did, from Vietnam to China. What happened in China?
China was a one-day thing. We probably shouldn't talk about it much. The long and the short of it is that, you know, we had 24 hours in which to see what we could. So we stuck to Beijing and went to the Forbidden Palace and Tiananmen Square, where we did get the experience. We got kicked out. Troops were actually kicking everybody out of the Tiananmen Square, and we thought, well, that right there is China. But not much to say. It was a stopover. You need a, unless you get a expensive visa, then you're confined to the city in which your airplane lands, and you can only stay 3 days.
So China, brief stopover on your way to Mongolia, where, as I remember the photos, you lived in a yurt and rode horses and were a Mongol.
Yes. Again, we used this organization, the Worldwide Organization of Organic Farmers, to work for our room and board. There was this Mongolian man and his Dutch wife who were working to build a tourist version, essentially, of the Mongolian experience. They wanted to build, you know, these yurts with all the accoutrements next to a building in which you could get your food from a cafeteria and also a spa treatment. But the nice thing was that none of that was built at the time. So Anna and I got to stay in real yurts and work along with some other international volunteers and just spend some time in that absolutely gorgeous country. Even more so than New Zealand, Mongolia really slaps you with the beauty of the natural world. In fact, unlike New Zealand, a lot of Mongolia is really untamed. Many Mongolians still live a nomadic existence. The Black Plague still pops up now and then, but fortunately, because there aren't many population centers, it just burns itself out. Dogs are still wild. If you see a pack of dogs running, you know, you make sure that you're not near them. So that was just an entirely new experience. In fact, every international worker there returned to the city with some form of infection.
Hmm.
And in the case of a Japanese gentleman, we had to make sure he got there because these sores kept spreading all over his legs. Like, it was clear that he needed some sort of treatment.
Oh, that's not pleasant.
No, none of it was pleasant and all of it was enjoyable.
There's our pull quote for the episode right there.
Maybe so. Every morning, our bosses would pass us out a hunk of meat and maybe some potatoes or something, you know, and we would just have to do our best to turn that into a somewhat interesting meal. It it's all rabbit food there. They can't believe they really don't understand all these vegetables that we eat. For them, that's stuff for deer.
Right, you've got to hang around too long in one place to be able to harvest vegetables.
Exactly. They really are the fantastic Klingons that we think of them as.
This is why I'm still over here inwardly chuckling at the idea of a Mongol resort and spa, because nothing says nomadic hunter lifestyle like having a spa that you can return to each day.
Sure, but you know, you can't sell money to tourists on the rough life.
This is true.
So what you usually have coming out of the capital are, you know, tours with jeeps that cost thousands of dollars. And if you don't do that, if you are willing not to do that, then you will get the full experience, which is incredibly dysfunctional, fantastically hospitable, and just adventure. More than any other place in the world we visited, Mongolia was an adventure. And that's, in many ways, what you want if you're going to go traipsing out your door.
Certainly. So from Mongolia, you moved on to Russia. Was this another train ride?
It was. This was the Trans-Siberian, or technically the
Trans-Siberian.
The Trans-Mongolian, I should say. And I should mention two things that really came in handy. First, our knowledge of Korean actually came in handy in Mongolia.
Really?
Yeah, would you believe it? There was a minority of Koreans there, and for historical reasons we won't get into, and also a fair amount of investments or charity work done by Koreans. In fact, the city buses all around Ulaanbaatar, when you got on, they were undisguised they were undisguised buses from South Korea. The timetables and everything were still on them. Nothing had been repainted. So we could tell that this bus used to take the route from Busan to Incheon or what have you. So actually bartering and everything else was really easy in Mongolia because a lot of the Mongolians spoke Korean. Who would have thought it?
One of the surprises.
Yeah, and for much more obvious reasons, there was a lot of Cyrillic around. A Mongolian variant of it, but there's not much difference. And in order to read signs, Anna and I decided that we needed to memorize the Cyrillic alphabet. So that came in handy. And I understand you knew it too.
Knew it. I don't know how much of the Cyrillic alphabet I still know, but yeah, I learned it when I was taking my two semesters of Russian. And I gotta say, I like the Cyrillic alphabet. Just for its simplicity, every letter has a sound, and it's not the hodgepodge that English is of trying to figure out which sound a letter makes in a given context.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Korean is a lot like that, too. Very straightforward. It wasn't hard to learn. So, took the Trans-Mongolian and spent several weeks in Russia, first traversing it, stopping at major cities that you've heard of, Irkutsk, obviously Moscow and St. Petersburg, and trying to get an idea of it. Wrap our heads around the enigma wrapped in a, I don't know the quote.
Mystery wrapped in an enigma, wrapped in a...
conundrum.
Tortilla or something.
Exactly. But let me tell you, and I may have said this to you privately, but we did not experience hospitality anywhere as much as we experienced it in Russia.
Yeah, I'm refreshing my memory off your postcard. You were able to couch surf through most of Russia.
Exactly. And of course, there's probably a decent reason for that, which is that, you know, there aren't as many tourists hitting up couch offerers. So, you know, you have more opportunities. But we met this great young couple that are marriage photographers in Moscow, and then we stayed with a college student and her grandmother in St. Petersburg. And by the way, the college student actually visited us at the beginning of this month.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, she came, she took a trip through America as a reward to herself for graduating with her master's at university. And so we got to see her for several more days. So it's and we've been in touch with a number of other people we've met around the world. That's been cool, having new friends.
That is always one of the fun parts of doing travel the way you did it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, man. Russia was one of the great surprises. I had the best cup of coffee I've ever had there. At a small little coffee shop that was themed after the cosmonauts, the 1950s and 60s.
How interesting.
It was. And they also had restaurants, a popular kind of restaurant that had a decorative theme. And that decorative theme was the Soviet era household.
Hmm.
You know, all the comforts that your grandparents would remember. So, and of course, to go with that, the traditional dishes, the borscht, and what have you. I feel like we got a really good taste of Russian culture while we were there, from the wonderful babushka who made us blinis in the morning, to getting to see Swan Lake at the original theater.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've discovered recently I'm not one much for ballet. Christine and I saw ballet together, and both of us agreed that it was an art form that was impressive, but one that we could go a good long time without ever seeing again.
Mm.
But if I ever find myself in Russia again, seeing Russian ballet is one of those experiences not to be passed up.
You can't really, pass up seeing the closest thing you can get to this historical artifact. And that's what took me there, but I actually did really enjoy it. I've seen ballet as well, and sometimes I'm bored, but I wasn't bored by that particular one. It was really well done.
Very good.
Yeah, I'm struggling for... What I am adopting, I think, is this point of thinking of one highlight or lesson from these countries as we go. But sometimes I feel like I'm a little aimless and we're just running down a laundry list.
Well, so from Russia, you made your way to Germany, and I've got a postcard here that shows a very interesting, I believe you said it was a Holocaust memorial.
Mm.
Looks like a bunch of concrete blocks and kind of almost a wave pattern.
Right. named subtly the Memorial to the Murdered Jews of Europe. Not to put too fine a point on it.
The Germans are such wonderfully blunt people.
Yeah, obviously if you're going to take a trip, then when you go through Poland and Germany, you're going to stop and see the Holocaust sites and the memorials to them. Seeing Auschwitz and Birkenau was very interesting. Not so much for the sites themselves, because from a lifetime of seeing them, you kind of already have a good mental image. But getting getting a spatial sense of it all, because you would recognize in a moment the gate that leads into Auschwitz with a train, but you would, in relation to the barracks, for example, you wouldn't know where those are. But the monument to the murdered Jews of Europe was the best of it, because there doesn't really seem like much you can do to react to these other memorials and monuments except acknowledge the tragedy of it. And it's all somewhat one note, if we're being honest. Whereas the memorial in Berlin felt different. It felt airy. It felt like a good graveyard, which is to say, you know, here are all these markers of the dead, but there's also, it's also a very pleasant walk.
Interesting.
And there is a sense that life continues. And, you know, if there are some little children there, then they'll probably just play among the gravestones. And you saw that. There were police to keep you from getting on top of them. But there was not a somber mood. It was a park as much as it was a memorial. And I thought that was there was something beautiful about that.
It's something I'd never heard of before, but now that I've seen the picture and I've read and heard the description, it's something I'm going to have to check. You know, I intend to get over to Europe at some point. That's definitely on Christine and I's bucket list, is to take a spin around Western Europe. And this is something I think I'm definitely going to have to see when I get to Germany.
I'm excited for you. And yeah, you'll definitely make that happen. But sure, if that Germany, if I had to choose one thing, it would be that monument. So I'm glad that I sent you that particular postcard.
So from Germany, you moved on to Holland and saw a little bit of and the Anne Frank House, I'm guessing, based on this postcard.
Right. And I suppose if there was... that was probably our last Holocaust memorial or monument, Anne Frank's house. And that was interesting. I don't know how much I really want to comment upon it. But there is... something does become much more tangible in your mind after you have... you know, gotten to run your hands along the beams of this house and this attic or annex, rather, in which, you know, these people lived. I really should read it again now that I've been there.
So how much of Holland did you actually see? Was just this just a quick pass through, a stop at Anne Frank's house, or was there more to the trip than that?
It was a 2-day trip. The Low Countries in general were just a handful of days each. Due to our own ignorance, we really had no idea what to expect, and we didn't allot much time as a result, because we were afraid we wouldn't have enough time for the stuff we really wanted to see. And of course, the result is that you go there, and of course, you're stunned by the wonderful possibilities of the place and all of these interesting things to do, and you vow to go again later.
It seems like one of the benefits of the... almost sprint that you took through Western Europe, going into each country, not quite sure what there was to see, is that if nothing else, it gave you a feeling for what was in each country or for what the mood of each country was, that it does set you up good for a return trip, that if you take another trip to Europe, you'll have a much better sense of what you want to do and where you want to spend your time.
True. At most, our trips to the Netherlands and Belgium, much like the Estonia and Latvia and Lithuania, were scouting expeditions passing through. In fact, we didn't even read history books or novels for those countries because, you know, we simply didn't have the time. If you're going to read 3 history books and 3 novels because your bus passes through these countries, you're giving yourself a lot of extra work to do. What I did not know or understand, I knew this about France, but not to the degree it was the case in Belgium, was how much they respect and enjoy the art form of the comic book. There was a museum of comic books, you know, a very nice museum, and the Europe takes them much more seriously. So that was interesting, seeing people reading them, you know, in public. And not just people. I think I should have taken out my camera and taken the picture, however it might have looked. But I remember this cafe in Belgium and sitting outside drinking an espresso was a beautiful woman in a red dress who was reading what looked like a collection of comic strips. I just thought I should have immigrated.
It felt, for the first time, like I had finally come home.
Yes, like I belonged. Oh, well, I did well enough for myself in the U.S. and Korea, I think. But it was a pleasure. There was, in fact, in the city of Brussels, a public art project whereby all the most famous cartoonists of Europe painted murals. And there was a map that you could get with the route that you could take to see all 40 of them. So, you know, there's Tintin on the side of one building, and then you move on further and you see someone else and so on and so forth.
As walking tours go, that's a unique and entertaining one.
Right? Right, but yeah, just anyway, those were byways or stopovers on the way to France.
On the way to France, which I was going to say, just from the little bit I know about Anna, I would assume was her highlight of the trip, being able to be back in France, or was this her first visit?
Back in France. In fact, her third time. Her first time was when she won a homeschooling competition for a free vacation there to Paris.
Hmm.
She put together an interactive French lesson for this competition, and she won a trip to Paris for herself and her parents.
Oh, cool.
It was timed well to coincide with her 16th birthday. So, yeah, that was one of her highlights of her life. And it certainly inspired her to continue learning French. You know, man, I don't know how you feel about it, but France, I tend to develop a sort of resistance to concepts and products and cities and ideas which are continuously pushed upon me as the best.
Mm-hmm.
So it took me a while to read the Harry Potter books because I just thought their fan base was annoying and I didn't understand why anyone would be so obsessed with just a book series. New York City, I'm sure it's not the be-all and end-all of the world. And wouldn't it be nice if every other movie wasn't filmed there? Let's have a little more variety. Paris, of course, is the most visited city in the world. It is the capital of tourist destinations, as well as France itself. And nevertheless, I really enjoyed myself. In fact, we visited twice. The first time was a week-long death march, during which, with military precision, we hit every highlight we could. Because, of course, there's so much.
The Champs-Élysées, the Louvre, the Triumph Arch, which I'm sure has a better name in French.
Arc de Triomphe.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, and a million other things besides. And so we managed to hit almost everything in that week. You know, not to say joyless, because we did enjoy this, but oh my god, did our legs ache by the end of the day. And then, after our trip was over, and we came back to France early to wait for our ship that would take us to the United States. And we spent an extra few weeks there. And we just spent that second trip to France, just living in it. Just enjoying life as Parisians. and that was a great experience, too. So everything you've heard about France, including how ungodly expensive it is true.
I'm afraid even with your recommendation, it's still going to be a while before I get to France and to Paris, because to me, Paris just feels like the most overhyped city in Europe, if not in the world. And there's, like you say, there's a certain level of inertia to getting over that and actually deciding to visit it, at which point I'm sure I'll be thoroughly charmed.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Because the real thing is never the flanderized, abstractified version that you've been sold on. In fact, one hilarious fact that I love to mention is that there is a hotline available in Paris for distraught Japanese tourists who are horrified that the city is not what they thought it was. There are counselors who talk them down.
The cliff of broken expectations.
Pretty much. If you thought it was this dream city, then it's not. But that's part of what makes it worth visiting, because it's not what what people think it is.
Paris destroying your illusions since 1876.
Oh, I don't know. The French Revolution surely gets in there somewhere. Right. I also visited the D-Day beaches, Normandy. And so that was interesting to see. Whenever you can get a real sense of the setting for all of these stories that you've repeatedly heard, that's worth doing.
Absolutely. So after France, I see here in our notes that you hit up Serbia, Greece, and Italy. And I don't really remember seeing much on Instagram or other social media related to these three countries. Was this just a sprint through them?
No, we spent quite a bit of time there. Perhaps what happened was just that we were too busy. In Serbia's case, Serbia was interesting because there wasn't much tourism going on. We stayed almost a full week because we have a very good friend from Serbia. And he lives in Novi Sad, which is not a small city in Serbia, but it is a sleepy one, I would say.
Okay.
And that was just a break, again, from the very stressful, even if it's enjoyable and a privilege and so on and so forth, you know, traveling around the world bit. So when we got to Serbia, it was just this fantastic relief to be hosted by someone who we trusted and who could show us where all the best shops were and would make every decision for us and who we could just take walks at night with and play games during the day somewhere. You know, it was a break. And for all that, Serbia is a wonderful country, and I highly recommend it. Another example of one of these countries that we tend to know nothing about because it just, you know, slips through.
Yeah, it almost feels like, I don't know if this is a universal trait or just an American trait, but it almost feels like we've got enough mental capacity to focus on a few countries per continent or per region of the world, which unfortunately means for continents like Africa with all of its wealth of nations.
Mm.
We mostly are oblivious to what's going on over there. And it seems like similarly, there's a lot of small countries in Europe and in Asia that we just don't have the mental attention to be able to be aware of.
It's true. And I think we should take a charitable view of that. I mean, we know from the Dunbar number that there are only so many people in the world we can keep track of. So it stands to reason that Americans, like everybody else, prioritizes you know, what they learn about and keep in their minds. Yeah, some people take a harsh view to the fact that the average American knows nothing about Africa and a whole lot about Europe, but I don't see that. Africa is just much less relevant to the average American. Yeah, that said, Greece and Italy are wonderful for the culture, in part, of course. You know, there you have these ebullient talkers with fantastic food, and it's just a wonderful expressive culture. But you also have this history, and there is again something deeply in perspective broadening about encountering these artifacts that are so amazingly old. You know, to get to stand on the hill where King Leonidas died with the 300 Spartans, to get to see the Temple of Poseidon that was around long before Jesus was a divine spark in God's eye, that's just humbling. And it really, much like the natural history of New Zealand, you feel like you you know, develop a more of appreciation for just how amazingly small you are in a lot of things.
And how little perspective you have a lot of times. I'm reminded of when Christine and I were in Houston 2 or 3 years ago, we visited Houston's Museum of Natural History.
Way to go see in Houston while you could.
Yeah. they had an exhibit on ancient Egypt. And walking through there and looking at the artifacts and looking at the various plaques and cards that described Egyptian history, I was just struck by how ancient Egypt really is, that it's a country that's fallen on hard times in modern history.
Mm.
But the sheer wealth of history that Egypt has, that Egyptian culture was 2,000 years old when the ancient Greeks visited and were poking around some of the libraries and cultural cities, centers in Egypt. Just the fact that at that point, Egypt had 2,000 years of history stretching back was just mind-blowing. That sheer wealth of whether it's Egypt or whether it's Italy or whether it's Greece, that you just go there and you're looking at stuff that has been around for a really, really, really long time. Like you say, it gives you this feeling of insignificance that we're going to be here for 80, 90 years. And how much of a dent are we going to make?
Exactly. Egypt, you know, in Greece, even credits that the ancient histories of Greece credits, Egypt with civilizing them, all of the earliest records, you know, I mean, and it's possible that they were just linking themselves to the august history of the of Egypt, much as it's said that the writers of Genesis linked Abraham to Ur, because that was well-known, you know, a glorious city of the past.
Right.
So it's possible the connection's somewhat false, but nevertheless, you know, the ancient Greeks respected this city and said that we were wild men, you know, before these Egyptian princes came over and decided to found some city-states here. So, very cool. I will mention, by the way, in the spirit of the by the same token as seeing Swan Lake in Russia, that we saw in Athens the play Lysistrata. And what is cool about that is not only is Lysistrata, of course, a classic Greek play, but the play takes place at the Acropolis, which is where the ancient theater that we saw the play was. So seeing, you know, this play that's thousands of years old in a theater in this within the historical ruins in which the play was said to have taken place was just really cool.
That is.
I feel like commentary on Italy is almost impossible. What do you even say about Italy? that hasn't been said 1,000 times before. What was cool is that my father-in-law came and stayed and spent that period with us, because my wife's family prides itself on its Italian heritage. So we went to South Italy, which is where his family is from, and he was over the moon, you know, just getting to walk around in the region where his ancestors are from. That was special for him.
Well, then I'll content myself with just asking, Italian pizza and spaghetti, did you get to try the originals?
I've never been a big spaghetti fan, but oh yeah, that is one of the things that you honestly get sick of over time if you're traveling in Italy. The grocery stores have plenty of diverse food, of course, but the restaurants are fairly one note. as are the stands and all the rest. You know, it's a lot of pizza and paninis. But it is as good as you've heard. So,
alrighty then.
I'll say that. Interesting that despite the fact that North Italy unified and conquered the country, that it's Southern Italian culture that conquered the world culturally. All of those foods that we identify with Italy are actually from, you know, below Rome.
Well, I suppose it's only fair, given that the Romans conquered Greece, and yet it was Greek culture that conquered the Roman Empire.
Yeah, here's a conundrum. Have you ever considered how interesting it is that Romans are the polar opposites, at least in reputation, as the Italians of today?
In terms of being warlike and expansionist?
Well, not only that, but you know, if the Romans were famously left-brained individuals who imported their culture from other countries, most specifically Greece, whereas Italians are considered to be fairly inept Mediterranean people with absolutely wonderful culture.
Yeah, that is ironic. I hadn't considered that before, but that... especially as a guy who listened to the entirety of the History of Rome podcast, that is ironic.
Yeah, it's just one of the things that, I don't know, strikes you, that that their development over the past 2,000 years has put them in a very different place.
Right. So Spain, you stopped in Spain on your way out of Europe, as it were.
Mm. So, yeah, and I think this basically concludes the little trip around the world, but let me... fast forward a bit. This year, my wife and I had our 8th anniversary. And to celebrate, we didn't do anything big, but we had some fun. We live streamed on Facebook ourselves playing one of those couple games where we ask a question and then we each write down the answers on whiteboard about each other. And so one of the great questions on there was, what countries do you have to visit again? Or what countries must you, you know, return to at some point? And amazingly, we both got ours right. But one of my two countries was Mongolia, for that glorious wildness that is still exists there. And the second was Spain. Spain was another one of those surprises, because really I didn't have a good sense of the culture. Do you?
I wouldn't say that I do, no.
Yeah, don't you feel like you have a sense of the French and the Italians and the Russians and the Germans, but beyond that ineptitude that Mediterranean adjoining countries seem to have in terms of economics and whatnot. You know, you get the sense that that the trains don't run on time. And you've heard of the hot-blooded Spaniard. But otherwise, you know, what do you know? I mean, what kind of food do they really eat? You know, when you think of Spanish food, you actually just start thinking about Mexican food, right?
Exactly.
So it was one of these great surprises. And since the country was really big, I read a history book in advance, but it was fairly dry and just about the ancient history leading up. And as it turns out, their culture is really interesting, in no small part because of the Muslim conquest that resulted in this great changing of their path, you know, their bifurcation, if you will, from normal European culture. So what's interesting is that they really live differently. You know, I mean, most of us can take a guess at when a Frenchman goes to that Frenchman's schedule. I mean, they would get up early in the morning, you know, they would go to work. They might, and then, you know, they'd go to work for an 8-hour day, 9-hour, whatever their great unions allow. And then they come home and then they do things like we do. The Spanish have a different schedule. They have the siesta that you've heard so much about. And over here, split shifts are almost a union, are almost a labor issue. Nobody wants split shifts. Whereas in Spain, you know, the idea that you don't get 4 hours off in the middle of the day is crazy. But not only that, they stay up late. Dinner starts at 10 p.m.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, or later. You know, if you can convince someone to go out with you and get food at 9, but they're like, what's your hurry? you know, it's just, it's different. So it's this nocturnal, you know, kind of people. And I mean, the hard partying people, partier is a common stereotype throughout the world. The people who just stay up until and get breakfast after they're done partying for the day. But that's not nearly so abnormal there. You know, it's like, I'm going out for the night. I'll be back in the morning. And moreover, when they go out, it's not necessarily to go clubbing or what have you. Spaniards, more than any country I know of, love to talk. You go to a park, and it's full of people, college students maybe or whatever, but they're just in small groups talking. You know, it's 11 p.m. at night, and they're not bored. They're not looking for something to do. This is what they came out to do. They came out to just jaw. So it's really cool to encounter a culture that really feels different. We happen to know an English teacher in Madrid, or she's since moved, but she was half Spanish. And she says that actually this can be a problem during presentations. I mean, you practically have to point a gun at some students' heads in many countries to get them to stand up before class and give a presentation. But in her classes, she says it's quite the opposite. She asks people what the answer is to a question, and then, you know, the first grader will raise the hand. And then eventually she has to tell them to shut up and sit down. Because they just want to pontificate for a while. Can you imagine?
Yeah, once
right?
you get started, you don't stop. Yeah, teacher's dream.
The
dream moving into a nightmare, I guess.
Exactly, the inverse of a teacher's dream.
Yes.
So that was cool. And I know I sent you a postcard, of course, but Barcelona was particularly special. I've seen it once, but if you can have an item on your bucket list twice, I would very much like to return to the Basilica de Sagrada Familia.
Yeah, that was indeed the postcard you sent me, was of the Basilica, and it is still, even just as a picture, one of the more beautiful things I've ever seen.
I sent everyone that postcard, or not everyone the same postcard, there were different angle shots and stuff, but, usually when you go to a country, you try to, or at least we tried to pick postcards based on the recipients. We think that Mom would be interested in this. We think that my friend Joe would be interested in this. But everyone got a card at the Basilica de Sagrada Familia. It is the world's most beautiful church. Wait another 5 years until they finish it, though.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to be a problem. But looking at this architecture, it's just, you do feel like one of, and I know there can be sordid histories to various of these churches around Western Europe. But at the same time, you look at the architecture and you look at the picture of so many of these churches that the Catholic Church built, and it just, there's a real beauty and a sense of grandeur in the way that they were built.
Absolutely. One thing that hits you, since perspective, for obvious reasons, is a theme that we keep touching on during this podcast, is how ossified or slow-changing architecture is in the religious community. Because the Sagrada de Familia is like nothing you've ever seen, but it was started over 100 years ago. And when you consider that, you realize how long it's been since anyone said, "We're going to build a new temple. You know what? Let's toss out the old rule book and go to town."
It's almost like what defines a temple or a cathedral is the continuity to the past. Mm. And there may be minor innovations on a theme, but it's almost like it wouldn't be a cathedral if you threw out the old rule book and tried something new.
Sure, yeah. If you didn't have the spires and so on and so forth. No, totally. It's all variations. And I think you're actually, you that was a fantastic comment. I think you're right that whether you believe or not, the function of a church or a temple is in large part to put people in mind of their heritage.
Right. Bring the past and the present together and give you that sense of continuity through time.
Mm. I gave you a postcard that I'm sure was of the inner sanctum, looking upwards at the glass and all the rest. But in large cathedrals, you will see small ironwork or stonework and scenes drawn, etched into the stone of biblical scenes. And even these were done in different styles. There was almost an abstract version of the crucifixion on perhaps it was the Western front that would be worth Googling just to see. The wonders don't just end with those beautiful jewel-like windows. There are a lot of fantastic details to look at.
Awesome. Literally awesome.
Mm-hmm, very much so, in the correct sense of the word. Yeah, so...
I was just going to wrap up by saying, and then after seeing all of these sites, you took a slow transoceanic passage home.
Right. Much as the world trip was meant to cleanse the palates or to take a breather before getting into this new phase of our lives, the transoceanic trip was meant to take a breather after the trip. and once we heard that you could take a trip not only on a cruise liner but on a cargo ship, we thought that would be really interesting and something different. Of course, the dream is to do like we did in Mongolia and New Zealand. It would have been great if we could sign up and do menial chores in the kitchen or something in order to work off passage as we crossed, but they don't really do that sort of thing anymore. In fact, the reason why they have so many cabins available for people like us is because automation has reduced the number of jobs necessary since those ships were built.
So you were quite literally staying in crew quarters for crew that had been obsoleted.
Yes, we were the only guests aboard, and we got a very nice cabin, actually. It was the cabin that is given over to the company representative when someone from headquarters is aboard.
Mm.
And so it was nicer than the crew cabins. But it was still an adventure, getting to cross the Atlantic. You'd never seen such pretty rainbows. Dolphins would come and join the ship, and that was all neat. And the crew was very accommodating. You know, they let us put on hard hats and go down into the engine rooms and skulk about and see all the interesting machinery. And as long as we asked permission first, we could go out on the deck and work our way around these massive cargo containers and explore. There was, you know, they probably would have changed if we had stayed longer, but we never ran out of something to do while we were there. And we pretty much had the full run of the ship. We could go up onto the bridge and keep the helmsman company.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, nothing was really forbidden. The crew's makeup is kind of interesting in a snapshot of where we are in the world. The officers, with one exception, were all from the Ukraine. They were all Eastern Europeans. And all of the crew members, with one exception, were Sri Lankans.
Interesting.
Yeah, and the company was French, but we are now past the point, essentially, where captaining a cargo ship or serving on it is a first world job. And we are almost to the point where it is a job that for skilled workers in third world countries.
Right.
I don't know, I found that interesting. It wasn't something I expected.
No, it's not something you tend to think about when you think of commerce.
Mm-hmm. We had our choice every day because there were usually two sets of meals prepared. There was one for the crew and one for the officers. And unfortunately for the officers, the crew, the kitchen was all Sri Lankan. So bless them, they did their best. And the Sri Lankan chef was always asking our opinion and their opinion as to whether they liked it. And the officers were, as Eastern Europeans tend to be, not especially effusive, regardless of how they felt about it. So you really felt for the cooks who were always looking for validation and never really getting it. But the Sri Lankan food was really good, so that was an unexpected bonus. And it was in
there. You go.
Yeah, it was interesting because, you know, everyone would explain their job. We asked the chef, you know, what his duties were and how exactly he budgeted. And apparently, he gets a set amount of money to work with, and he sends out an order whenever they make port. And the port authorities will bring that to them. You know, all of this small stuff. I actually have a lot of notes because, of course,
yeah, you had time to make a lot of notes at this point.
Very much so. And as a writer, everything is material that you're supposed to cash in later.
So how long was this trip? I remember this was, what, 2-3 weeks you were out on the Atlantic?
Not that long. It was a week straight, I believe.
Okay.
And one thing that I failed to mention, and I may have told you, I know I posted it on Facebook, but we were at sea in early November, which means that we missed the presidential election.
I was going to say, you came home to a gold-plated surprise.
Yes, yes, we did. We were told by the captain that Trump had won, but we didn't actually believe him. And not only because we were incredulous and horrified at the idea, but because even though he was right about the basic fact, he was wrong about the particulars. Like, I think he said that Trump won California, which we knew couldn't be correct. He didn't have a good sense of American politics, and he didn't really pay attention to the details. So it seemed like a paper-thin story. So anyway, when we actually got into port and we made our way through the industrial area, I just said to a waiting dock worker, "So who's president?" Or who's going to be president? He looked at me all bug-eyed and then said, "Well, it looks like it's going to be Trump." He said, "Where you been?" And I jerked a thumb back at the ship, and he was like, "Oh."
"Excuse me, my good man, I've just come in from the year 2473. Who's president?"
Right, well, that's what it felt like coming out the other side of a portal and then picking up one of those newspapers to see what you've missed.
Right.
And then deciding, oh, God, it was like an episode of Sliders. There's clearly a problem here, and how do we solve it?
At what moment did this timeline go wrong, and how do we fix it?
Exactly. So that was interesting. Being in New York City immediately after Trump's election was kind of interesting, because it felt like the World Trade Center had been struck again. In this extremely liberal city, there was this great depression that had fallen over everything, this pall.
Right.
And the subway, in fact, much like in the course of a national tragedy, someone had left about 1 million boxes of post-it notes and markers. And so everyone was writing on this wall and posting their thoughts and their feelings and everything. And so the whole subway wall had been pasted over by messages of essentially condolences and well wishes from travelers. And also messages of fury and, you know, screw you, Trump, and all the rest. We will be strong, yada, yada, yada. So that was interesting. And also we were staying for those couple of days with my brother-in-law, who is from Brooklyn and in many ways one of the right out of Central Casting, although he would hate for me to say that. a good ending though, and a memorable trip.
Yeah,
the nice thing is we recorded it. You know, I feel like we did a good job of that. I read a history book for every country. I read a novel for every country, except for the little flybys. We journaled, and we took 1 second a day of footage, which we turned into a mural. So, you know, without letting the recording get in the way of enjoying the trip, I feel like we did a decent job of documenting it.
Yeah, having something that you can look back on over the years and have a concrete memory.
Right, that and the library from around the world.
So as you look back over the entire trip, I guess if you were to try to sum up the entire experience or to give your overall feelings after the experience, what pops into your mind?
You really want, as I said before, you really want life and traveling to mean something. You feel like it should be more than just entertainment. So when I think back on it, it depends on where I'm at. Sometimes I do it just as a way of looking back on some fond memories whenever I'm feeling a little down or just tired with the daily grind of being back in the hometown. Sometimes I consider lessons learned, and it often comes up whenever I'm grasping for perspective. I think I make reference, hopefully not in an annoying way, but I make a reference to the rest of the world more often when I'm discussing a subject. So I think I accomplished one of my missions, which was broadening my view. And it's a classist thing to say, everyone should go traveling, because of course not everyone is privileged to go traveling and to have the money available for that or be in the situation where they don't have responsibilities keeping them where they are. But it's an education, and I'm glad I had it.
Very good. Yeah. I feel like I should have some grand statement to sum up this entire episode, but I don't, other than to say that I enjoyed it. I enjoyed hearing the stories and having a small piece of living vicariously through your experience.
Hey, as I look forward to living vicariously through yours. I'll tell you one thing that about traveling. You don't get it out of your system. It's a addictive drug. You will not feel less jealous that someone is going to Germany after you've been to Germany.
How are you going to keep them down on the farm when they've seen Grand Paris?
Yeah, I don't know if I put it that way. I do enjoy life back here. It's just you know, that you always, but yeah, you'll always want to go again. Hopefully, when
I suppose, if nothing else, it gives you a certain restlessness that develops over a sense of time that eventually you'll reach that point where you're like, it's time to go. Even if it's just a 1 week trip, it's time to go see something.
This is a defining trait of my life. As I told you before, I've never lived anywhere more than 5 years. And so I do have this sense that moving is not so much a pain in the butt as a chance to wipe the slate clean and move on to the next stage in your adventure. I feel like, I feel like, you know, everyone feels like they've personally grown in their lives. And for me, moving to a new place is the easiest way to categorize the phases of my life. And so, oddly enough, as a result, I feel that moving back to somewhere I've already lived kind of feels like a step backward.
I can see that.
As if I'm regressing personally as well as returning to a particular location.
We've already been through chapter 4. Why are we coming back?
Exactly. Not true, of course. And it's nice to be back with friends and family in Atlanta.
Absolutely.
Well, thanks, Joe, for letting me rant for a little bit and about all my time abroad. And it's always... No traveler wants to do anything other than share their experiences, but they're also always worried that they're being annoying by doing so. So it's great to have an ear.
If you liked the show, help new listeners find it by listening to Reacquainted and rating it in Apple Podcasts. Just go into Apple Podcasts, subscribe to Reacquainted, and rate it. You can also see announcements for new shows, episodes, and upcoming live streams by following @FromVoxDuo on Twitter. Joe blogs at MinorThoughts.com and is on Twitter @JMartinDF. Adam is on Twitter as well, @AdamVolley. That's Adam, V-O-L-L-E.
And I guess we should tell our dear Vox Populi that this is our last planned episode for Reacquainted. We've reached the end of the topics that we originally set out to discuss. So after you listen to this, there may very well not be a new podcast episode in your podcast player of choice 2 weeks from now.
Yeah, whether we do some sort of wrap-up or not is not even decided, but I would like to take a moment to give a shout-out to Joe, who has managed to keep us on track with his editing and skills for the entire period. I don't think we missed a week, did we, Joe?
We didn't miss a week, and we hit Tuesday morning at 6 a.m. every single time, and this is the point where I feel like I should be all humble and say, "Oh shucks, it was nothing." But frankly, you know, I don't do well sticking to a schedule and getting stuff done on a regular cadence. So I'm just going to say I am darned happy with the fact that I actually managed to keep this to a regular cadence for the past 34 weeks, publishing on time every time.
Way to go. And your experience may influence what we choose to do in the future. A project not as of yet decided upon.
Yeah, certainly. I think we've both got some ideas and some thoughts, but we haven't nailed it down. So we'll see what comes next.
Yeah, if you have any, please give us a holler. Since you are not only our few prized listeners, but also probably family and friends, you have... you have a stronger influence than someone might normally have.
Your opinion actually matters to us. It's not just something we say.
Yeah, in the case of our spouses, you even wield a veto.
This is true. This is true.